Innovation. A new report just out is showing how little is done in Australia, despite our superb scientific base. Only 6% of businesses are investing in R&D, as was reported on RN Breakfast on Thursday. Well, former economics professor Andrew Lee MP has a new book with Joshua Gans on how innovation can give Australia a better future. It's called Innovation and Equality.
You mention two people particularly in your book, one of them being a hero of mine called Joseph Schumpeter. Tell me the three things that he was most ambitious to achieve.
Well, he hoped to be the best economist, the best lover, and the best horseman. And at the end of his life, said he'd achieved two out of three, but wouldn't say which ones.
But he's very famous for talking about the burning deck theory of innovation. In other words, if the deck is burning and you're going to sink, you think of something really lateral, if you like. Another way of looking at it is if you go back to the Second World War, there people had to innovate like crazy. And if you look at Britain's record with help from at least one Australian, penicillin, Howard Florey, there's the radar work, and I'm thinking of Robert Hanbury Brown, the original Boffin, and, of course, Alan Turing with computers. And all of that was done in something like 4 years. There was a state of war. The deck was burning, so you had to come up with good stuff.
It's extraordinary. It's almost like the way in which diamonds and pearls are produced. Through that pressure comes great innovation. But I think we also need to envisage circumstances in which we set up innovative ecosystems that can work effectively over decades through peacetime, through structures which encourage innovation as being a normal part of life. Not something that a quirky few do, but democratizing innovation.
Of course, another example of that is a few hundred years ago when the plague ravaged Europe and about 25% or more, 30% of the population was wiped out. And of course, there was no labour. And so if there's no labour, you had to invent things. And some of the most amazing inventions of science itself, perhaps, came in that period. So what about your proposition that we need to have a more peaceful and constant way rather than a burning deck to have innovation? How do we organise that?
Plenty of innovation comes out of crisis, but crisis need not be the only mother of invention. I believe there's many contexts in which we're going to see jobs augmented by artificial intelligence. It won't take away every job that exists, but it'll probably change all of our jobs. And the hope that Joshua and I have is that it improves the quality of jobs, takes away the routine, mundane parts, and allows humans to do what we do best, working in teams, creatively solving problems, rather than doing work like remembering large amounts of information or repetitively processing things. Those tasks will increasingly fall away.
I gave some examples during the Second World War which seemed to be directed. In other words, you plan to have an antibiotic, you plan to have radar, you plan to have computers. Now, you say in the book, the other name, apart from Schumpeter you mentioned, is the person who says that, well, here you've got barrels of apples, and some of them are bad, some of them are crisp, and you can't necessarily tell which is which when you put your hand in blind. And similarly, you can't necessarily have innovation just turn up as directed.
Frank Knight is critical to how economists think about uncertainty and risk. He says risk is the notion that when you've got a bag which is 50-50 crisp and bad apples, then you don't know what sort of apple you'll get, but you know what the bag looks like overall. Uncertainty is where you don't know whether the bag is 50% good apples or just 10% good apples. And we think that a lot of the way the world looks like is uncertainty. The technological change is fundamentally uncertain, Robin. And we can't know, if you're a young person trying to plan a career, what are going to be the growth occupations and which occupations will shrink. So you should plan your life and structure your social institutions so as to embrace that fundamental uncertainty.
I can't help asking, given the climate problems we've got, that setting out to remove carbon from the atmosphere and doing something as creative as that is something that you could plan and bring off.
Certainly climate change is something we ought to do, but it's governed by significant uncertainty as well. We simply don't know, particularly for high levels of warming, what the impact will be on the planet. And in that regard, we want to be cautious because the expected value of a very bad thing happening can be large, even if it's relatively improbable.
There are many people who think that the climate challenge is just the sort of thing that Schumpeter would have recommended. But you, in your book, give 10 suggestions, requirements, really, for effective innovation. Could you give us two or three of them?
We think it's important to set up ecosystems in which young entrepreneurs can have access to what we call a market for judgment. It's an idea that comes from the Creative Destruction Lab at the University of Toronto, which Joshua helped to create. And it stems from the notion that young entrepreneurs have great ideas, but don't necessarily know how to put them into practice. We think it's important to harness the talents of the 51% of the population who are women. Sexual harassment is not only economically inequitable, but it's also inefficient. And it means that research organisations, businesses, misses out on talented women. Systems that encourage bystanders to speak out against sexual harassment are going to be absolutely critical. And we think it's important to uncover those lost Marie Curies and lost Albert Einsteins, talented youngsters in disadvantaged backgrounds whose parents were not entrepreneurs, who, with a little bit of opportunity and perhaps access to finance, might well turn into the next Mark Zuckerberg or Steve Jobs.
And, of course, you also recommend that we need very, very good teachers and that the standard of teaching has slipped. How do you fix that?
Finland faced this problem a generation ago when its test scores were behind where Australia was at that stage. They decided they would have a central focus on teacher quality, on attracting and retaining talented people into the teaching profession. Finland now draws teachers from the top tenth of the distribution and scores among the best in the advanced world on international tests, such as the OECD's PISA test. So it can be done, but it's about focusing education policy on what people across the ideological spectrum agree really is the number one issue in education policy.
It's interesting, you've hardly mentioned government at all, because what we want to say, why doesn't government do it? Why doesn't leadership do it? Why don't you put the money in where it's required?
There is an important role for government. The thing is that business significantly underspends. The collaboration is very low. So we need a bit of a change in culture as well as a change in opportunities for young people. This is also something that needs to be done with a sense of optimism, Robin. That notion that it's not beyond our wit to be more innovative and more equal. And indeed, just look back to the post-war decades in which most advanced countries innovated like crazy and wages grew faster on the factory floor than the corner office.
And where does equality come into it?
Equality is fundamental to a good society. If the gap between rich and poor grows too wide, you lose that sense of shared purpose that a good society needs. Right now, we've got a situation in the United States where the poorest 90% have less wealth than the top 0.1%. The poorest 270 million Americans, less wealth than the richest 300,000. That's unsustainable in my view. So egalitarianism is also a part of holding a society together, and so we can all raise living standards into the future.
But it does seem that the United States is innovating very strongly.
It does, but Joshua and I don't think that's because it's unequal. We don't think inequality is the price of progress. We not only point to the post-war decades, but also to careful studies that have been done that look at why people get into innovating. It's not just because of the size of the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. It's because the barriers at the start were surmountable. And those barriers, for some people, can deter them, can hold them back. And that's when society misses out on their innovation and where we become too unequal. So, for example, in the area of social networks, we think that you need systems that ensure that new social networks can plug into the existing ones so the monopolists don't entirely take over.
Final question, is this change or set of changes urgent or can we just glide through?
Absolutely urgent. We think that the time to change is now and that the exciting prospects really are there.
Andrew Lee, MP, with an urgent message on R&D. His new book is called Innovation Plus Equality: How to Create a Future That is More Star Trek Than Terminator.